From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It often happens when you approach midlife or you're not happy at work that you consider doing dumb stuff. It's kind of where Jonathan Gottschall was a few years ago when he noticed a mixed martial arts gym had opened across the street from his office. And at some point after he worked it out a little, he decided to become a cage fighter, or at least have one real fight. Gottschall is a scholar, a professor, and part of what he wanted to explore was how violence works in human cultures, particularly why men fight. But there's more to it than that. A lot of this was personal. He says in his book he wanted to fight because he was fascinated by fighting, and really, he wanted to do it because he wanted to know if he was a coward. Today in the program, Gottschall is joining us to talk about his book and his experience, and we invite you to join us after the news.
Purchase the books that you hear featured on Radio West by clicking the IndieBound, Amazon, or Audible links included with each show at RadioWest.org. A portion of proceeds from these affiliate partners supports Radio West. While you're there, you can check out all the show archives. Thanks for listening.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the scholar and writer Jonathan Gottschall's career was dead in the water, and he wasn't really sure what to do about it. He says he was looking for some kind of a push to maybe help him move on to something else, or maybe even find something to provoke his bosses into firing him. And that's when he noticed the gym across the street. It was one of those academies of mixed martial arts where guys fight in those chain link cages. And he figured if becoming a cage fighter didn't get him fired, at least it could provide material for a book about the human inclination for violence. For years, he had been thinking about why men fight and why so many of us like to watch men fight. And he knew he wasn't the first to explore the subject by actually getting in the ring, but he worked out the basics. It would be, he writes, about the struggles, sad and silly and anachronistic, though they might seem, that men endure to be men. And it turns out the new twist on the subject that he put in it was the personal reasons for wanting to fight. In his book, he wrote that he admits he wanted to fight because he'd always backed down from fights in the past. Today in the program, Jonathan Gottschall is joining us to talk about his book and his experience. The book is called The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. Jonathan Gottschall is a literary scholar, a distinguished fellow in the English department at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania. He has a lot of books, among them The Storytelling Animal. And he's joining us today from the studios of NPR member station WQED in Pittsburgh. And Jonathan Gottschall, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, Doug. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So I sort of did the little setup there that you mentioned in the book about what got you thinking about this. And it's interesting how personal the motivation for you was, which we'll get to. But you say you were also looking to go beyond just an academic look at all of this, because you'd written about violence, of course. But you say that you had learned it from an armchair, like you had never really experienced real violence. And I wanted to start there. Why was that so important, the idea of actually having an experience like that?
Well, you know, there's a sort of stunt element to this book. You know, going into it, I was like, you know, part of the reason you write a book, you choose your subject, is like, well, what will people be interested in? And there's a sort of element of, well, I can do something kind of crazy that will draw attention. But by like the second day in the gym, the whole stunt element was out the window. And I realized that this was incredibly valuable to do this research. There's things about fighting that you simply will never understand unless you've actually done it. There's something incredibly educational about getting punched in the face.
Yeah.
There's something incredibly educational about being locked up in a chain link cage with another guy, and the guy is a trained killer. And the only way out of that cage is to fight your way through him. And so I learned a great deal about violence by actually fighting that I could have never have learned from my library cubicle.
Right. Explain your initial impression of mixed martial arts, because you say in the book that you saw it pretty much as it's bad for athletes, it's bad for society in general.
Yeah, I went across the street initially to prove the thesis. And the thesis was that mixed martial arts is basically this perfect metaphor for something dark and black and nasty at the core of human nature. I wanted to use mixed martial arts as this metaphor, as this bridge into all these questions about sort of the dark side of human behavior. And in general, that thesis did not hold up. Most of the things that I expected to find, I did not find in the end.
It seems like the central thesis of the book that you kind of discover is that this really isn't about the darkness of men, as you put it in the book. It's about how men keep darkness in check. Like that this kind of violence, the rituals, the rules, and we'll get to all of that, is really about us not getting to a point where someone really gets hurt.
Yeah. So I put this in sort of a biological context. In the book, you know, the big idea running through all the chapters in the book is something that I call the monkey dance.
Yeah.
And if you've ever seen like a nature video and you've seen a couple of elephant seals clashing in the surf, or you see a couple of mountain goats cracking skulls on a hillside, biologists call those kinds of contests, they call them ritual combat. It's a way that all these different animal species have developed to figure out who's bigger and stronger and tougher and fitter without the danger of actually fighting it out to the bitter end, to the death. And humans are animals too. We sometimes like to forget that, but we're animals, we're complicated animals, we're cultured animals, but we're still animals. And the monkey dance is my name for human versions of ritual combat. Everything from deadly duels to verbal duels to the play fights of boys to sports. Including sports like mixed martial arts and football. And the key thing to remember about these monkey dances is that they will often seem silly and stupid and pathetic, sort of like macho nonsense. But on the whole, they're a good thing. On the whole, we should be grateful for them because they function to channel aggression down relatively safe pathways.
I want to have you read a section from the book. This is early on. We should set up this scene. This is where you're first exposed to a cage fight. It's in the first one of its kind of this. There's this new sporting group called the Ultimate Fighting Championship, UFC, now incredibly well known and of course popular. But this first one seemed designed kind of for novelty. I mean, they had this massive Hawaiian sumo wrestler fighting this kind of stoic Dutch black belt guy. Is that all we need to set this up? Because I want to have you read this.
I would say one more thing about it. It wasn't for shock value. The point is that they didn't actually know what worked in fights.
Right.
And the UFC was about figuring out what actually worked in fights, what styles were best, was speed more important, or was power more important. So they put a 400-pound man in the cage with the 200-pound man partially to answer that question. What mattered more in a fight, all the power of this sumo wrestler or the speed and technique of the karate fighter?
Yeah.
And I can start reading now.
We should mention the names. The sumo wrestler, Taylor Tooley, right?
Yep.
And then the Dutch black belt, Gerard Gordeaux.
Gordeaux, yep.
Right.
So I'll read. When Gordeaux entered the cage, Tooley's mask of serene confidence, of manly insouciance, began to slip. Tooley moved nervously in his corner, sucking down huge lungfuls of air and spewing them out again. As the camera panned to Gordeaux's corner, it was clear why. Gordeaux didn't look like a man who was about to be sacrificed to a giant. He just stood there, flat-footed, slump-shouldered, and breathing normally through his nose, as if he were running a pulse of about 40. And he watched Tooley, not with the, quote, mean mug of a fighter trying to intimidate, but with a serial killer's blank stare. His look said to Tooley, not unkindly, "This is nothing to me. You are nothing to me." The bell rang, and after a few seconds of circling and fainting, Tooley tipped himself toward Gordeaux and let gravity take over. Gordeaux pivoted like a matador and stung Tooley with a hard punch as he charged by. Unbalanced, Tooley crashed face first into the bottom of the fence. As the huge man struggled to rise, Gordeaux stepped in, wound up, and soccer kicked Tooley, full power in the mouth. The crack of the blow was so terrible, the spray of blood and slobber so dramatic, that the referee jumped in to stop the fight. But not before Gordeau crouched down for a haymaker that spun Thule around and left him sagging against the fence. The whole fight lasted 20 seconds. Thule hauled himself upright and shuffled out of the cage, complaining through the gory hole of his mouth that he wanted to fight on. Gordeau left the cage with a fractured right fist and one of Thule's front teeth broken off inside his foot. Gordeau had punted Thule's other front tooth straight through the chain-link cage, past the announcers' heads, and into the crowd.
Now, you saw this scene you mentioned in the book. This was a few years later. It was on a videotape. You say in the book that you and your friends, when you watched this, I mean, looking at that particular scene, because it was pretty gory, even for 20 seconds, you said it made you sick to your stomach, but like you couldn't look away. And there were other fights on this videotape.
Yeah.
And you watched and watched and watched. What were you looking for? What were you looking at? Because that seems to get at the essence of why we watch.
Well, yeah, you know, and this is a question that has really confused me ever since I watched this fight, because for the last 15 or 20 years, I've been watching fights on TV, and I've been watching them as a fan. I've always watched them in this spirit of guilty fascination. I'd be thinking to myself, I'm a civilized human being. I'm a peace-loving person. I appear not to be a sociopath. So why am I watching this, you know?
Yeah.
What's drawing me to this? What's wrong with me? And what's wrong with all of us? Because even those of us who wouldn't be caught dead at a cage fight or at a boxing match still consume a huge amount of violent spectacle. Violence is really, even more than sex, the main staple of our entertainment economies. I think there, you know, as hard as it is to admit it to ourselves, there's a creature in us, a creature that actually likes violence.
There's a kind of a brutal honesty throughout the book, really. And one of the reasons you mentioned as to why you wanted to fight was because, and this is how you put it in the book, you envied the manly excellence of the fighters and their courage. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of where the book gets really personal. Because you point out in the book you attracted bullies when you were a kid, and you tell one story out of a many that you mentioned were that happened in your life, but you tell this one story where you were humiliated by a senior on the football team, and you were a sophomore. Will you tell that story, because this seemed really kind of important in the scheme of things?
You know, it is important, and I'll tell you, Doug, it's funny to me, even as you start to set that story up, I start to blush a little. I'm still humiliated by it. I'm still ashamed by it. And it's shocking to me and fascinating, because I'm 42 years old, and this happened at least 25 years ago. And it's amazing how much psychological weight this carries in my life. And so what basically happened was I was on the tennis team, and we were screwing around on the tennis team, and I insulted another player, jokingly. And this guy was not really a tennis player. I was a real tennis player. It was my main sport. He was not. He was kind of screwing around. He was one of the heroes of the football team. And in the off season, he played tennis. And so my little playful insult hit him the wrong way, and he levitated over the net and pushed me up against the fence and sort of slapped me around and threatened me, and I backed down completely. I mean, there was no way I could win this fight unless I attacked his face I attacked his fists so savagely with my face that he would have to surrender.
Yeah.
And so he gets done slapping me around, and I stand there against the fence, shamefaced. And I look up, and there's my father. My father was there watching the practice. And so it was this accumulated sense of shame. Everyone sees it. When these sorts of situations, these situations of real dishonor among boys and men happen, it's always about who's watching. So all my peers saw it, and even my dad saw it. Not that I lost a fight, but that I was too much coward even to have the fight.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, and you mentioned that you and your father didn't ever really talk about it. And you say that, you know, he knew he shouldn't be ashamed of you. But as you put it in the book, how could he help himself? I mean, you know, he was a man, right? And he probably
was. Yeah, that's right. It was a big moment in our lives. You know, this is not something that wouldn't be part of dinner conversation.
Right.
But we never spoke of it. I came home. He didn't say anything about it. I didn't say anything about it. And, you know, my dad's an educated guy. He's a smart guy. He's a gentle guy. He doesn't have some sort of swaggering sense of masculinity. But there's just something deep down in most men that recognize my behavior there as deeply disreputable, deeply dishonorable. It's not that I could have won the fight, but it's that I should have stood up for myself.
Yeah.
It's kind of – these are the kinds of questions about masculinity that really drew me into the book. You know, why does a guy like me have this sort of archaic, barbarian, why am I freighted with this barbarian concept of masculinity, even as, you know, sort of an educated, modern person?
This is interesting, too. I mean, you write that you didn't fight because you figured you couldn't win. I mean, you know, this guy was a linebacker. He jumps over the net. He goes after you. You're cowering. You're a sophomore. Yeah. He's a senior. And you thought, well, gosh, yeah, I mean, I'm not going to fight this guy. He can't win. But then you say, and this seems like another really important theme, what does winning or losing really have to do with it? And you quote that line from Braveheart where that guy says, look, we don't have to defeat the British. We just have to fight them. And that seems like a really important point. I mean, this is kind of something that you learned that it doesn't really matter if you win. The idea is that you step up, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the unspoken but clear ethic of male behavior is that, you know, it doesn't really matter if you lose a fight so long as you compete bravely. And there's a reason for it. Even in losing a fight, you send a message. And the message is, I'm not meat. I'm not a prey animal. It will be hard to exploit me. And basically in high school, in middle school, by not fighting, I sent a message to all the bullies that I was exploitable. And they sure enough, you know, exploited me.
This gets us to the question of honor, which we'll come back to when we get back from a break. Jonathan Gottschall is with us. His book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer, scholar, Jonathan Gottschall, to help us explain why we men like to watch a fight and why we fight ourselves, because apparently this works quite differently for men. And even though we feel ambivalent about violence, it can look ugly, but it's attractive enough that we can't really look away. There's a biological component in here, of course, in Gottschall's book, which we'll talk about. It's also really personal. There's some pretty cool information about duels in here, too. The book is called The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. So I wanted to talk about dueling. One very particular story of dueling that you tell in the book is the story of the Hamiltons, Alexander Hamilton, of course. And most of us know this part of the story. You know, he's one of the country's founding fathers. He dies in this duel with Vice President Aaron Burr. But you also remind us that his son, Philip, also died in a duel 3 years before that.
That's right, yeah. And some of Hamilton's descendants, I mean, other family members also fought duels even afterwards. And so I use the story of Philip Hamilton's death, to drive home this big riddle of the duel, which is why did intelligent men, and few men have been more intelligent than Alexander Hamilton, why would these intelligent men have risked so much over what seemed like so little? Because, you know, they're risking their lives, and usually they're risking their lives over gossip and silly little insults. And so Hamilton goes to his duel not wanting to fight Burr,
right,
being morally opposed to the duel on Christian grounds, and still mourning the death of his beloved son Philip, who died just 3 years previously on almost the same spot of New Jersey real estate. And now, you know, this seems like an incredibly quaint relic of the past, the duel. But, you know, the whole psychology of male honor, the duel is dead, right, but the whole psychology of male honor that led men to think it was worth it to risk everything over a silly little slight, that is absolutely still with us. So when men fight each other today, when they kill each other today, it's usually over the same issues of honor that motivated those duelists. Someone feels disrespected. Someone feels dishonored. There's an insult. There's words back and forth. And before you know it, it escalates and the men are fighting and maybe somebody's laying on the sidewalk.
It's interesting because I always thought of honor as just a cultural construct. But it seems like you can find honor in the kind of the biological imperative to fight. I mean, I guess in that way you could say a gorilla has a sense of honor or a bull elk has a sense of honor. That they're more than just vying for dominance. It's about respect and keeping these imperatives in check, violence in check. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there is a sort of biological foundation to this. Honor is absolutely, or the need for respect, the need for status is absolutely a cross-cultural universal. It's something that men in particular take very seriously. You find different kinds of duels all around the world. So they might duel in different ways. So the Yanomamo Indians in South America will bash each other on top of the head with poles from their houses. And the Inuit will have a sort of punching contest where they'll take turns throwing haymakers at each other. So there's different forms of the duel, but they're always recognizably duels. And why would animals and why would people care so much about respect? Why would they care so much about status? Well, there's very good reasons. You know, people with a lot of respect and animals with a lot of respect have really good lives.
Yeah.
And people without a lot of respect and a lot of status may feel like they have no life at all. So when you're fighting over honor, or over respect, it will often seem really silly, really stupid. Why would you risk something so much over something you can't even see or touch? But really, honor is coin. Respect is coin that buys the best stuff in life.
You cop to the fact pretty early on in the book that this idea of having, you know, a writer prepare to go into the ring, you know, is kind of a formula. I mean, a lot of others have done it. You mentioned George Plimpton and Matt Pauley and Sam Sheridan. And there came this point in when you were thinking about all of this that, okay, others have done it. The hook for my book may have gone blunt, as you put it. Mm-hmm. And really all that was, at least if I understand this right, was you kind of trying to find a way out, kind of an excuse. And what you realized was you were trapped in that same kind of sense of honor. You were really drawn into it in that way.
Absolutely. This was really fascinating to me because the difference between a normal fist fight and a cage fight or a boxing match is delay.
Yeah.
So I knew for months that I was going to be in a car crash, you know, on a certain date. You know, I knew this very violent thing was going to happen to me. And that's what duelists dealt with, too. Duelists were dealing with this delay of days or weeks or months where all they could do is sit around and stew waiting for the gunfight or waiting for the sword fight to occur. And like most duelists, I spent a lot of time trying to negotiate a way out of my mess. I negotiated almost exclusively with myself. I'd run down all the reasons why I shouldn't do it, all the danger, and so forth. And by the end, I got to this point where I was like, well, you know, other people have done this, and if it hasn't been done to death by other writers, at least it's been done. And I started telling people, you know, I think maybe I won't have this fight after all. And my friends at the gym would say, huh, so you're chickening out, huh? And it became very clear to me that if I didn't fight, I would lose respect. I would lose status, not just in the gym, but with my friends, with my colleagues, with my family even. And before I knew it, I was sort of trapped in this real live affair of honor. If I fought, I would gain honor. If I didn't fight, I would lose honor. There was this great line about Hamilton's duel. One of his friends, after Hamilton's death, wrote to another friend, if we were really brave, we would not accept a challenge to duel. Mm-hmm. But we are all cowards. So you duel because you're too afraid of what people will say about you if you do not duel. And I was in exactly that situation. I was afraid. I was more afraid of what would happen to me, of the social consequences of not fighting, than I was afraid of the physical consequences and the physical danger of actually fighting.
Jonathan Gottschall, give us a sense of what it's like to get punched in the face. But set this up for us. And maybe we should start with Mark Schrader. He's the guy, sure, who's going to show you what it was like to get punched in the face.
Yeah, Mark was my Mark is my coach, my MMA coach, and he was an ex-boxer. And when you fight Mark, you feel about as helpless as a punching bag. You just really don't have much hope. And I had been at the gym for a couple of months, and I told Mark that I really wanted him to hit me. I wanted to know what it felt like to really be hit. And not knowing Mark as well as I know him now, that was a bad thing to say. It was a bad thing, a dumb thing to say to Mark Schrader. And here's what happened. So he lands this really heavy left hook. Right. And now I'll read. Simultaneous with the brain pain, my consciousness flickered out and I started to tip like a chopped tree. But in the next moment, I realized that it was just my perception of the world that was tipping, not my actual body. And when I blinked, the world heaved itself upright. I realized that I was reeling across the cage, and Schrader was pursuing with a predatory look in his eyes. I backpedaled, weaving here and there, bouncing off the cage. A few times, I literally turned my back on Mark in panic and ran for it. But no matter how fast I fled, he was always right there hitting me. The barrage never stopped. Shots to the belly, shocks to the arm, whip-crack jabs, bomb crosses, and the terrible concussive explosions of his left hooks going off inside my brain, filling the cage with a snow of glinting golden flakes. I tried to fight back, flailing my arms in Mark's general vicinity, but he seemed almost offended that I had the gall to try to hit him, and he stung me with counterpunches. After what seemed like forever, Mark backed off to let me gasp. Hiding behind my gloves, I flicked my eyes at the clock. The sight crushed me. There were still nearly 2 minutes left in a 3-minute round, and I was already worn out from the punches and the running and the fear.
You have two eureka moments in that 1 minute. The first one you say is that it made you really get that the main object of fighting is you need to shut down the other guy's brain. And the other part is that it's really exhausting. As you said, you know, you thought, I don't know, 5-10 minutes had gone by and really barely a minute.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. You know, this is the day that I realized, oh, there is an incredible scholarly and intellectual value in actually getting in the cage and actually experiencing the violence rather than just reading about other people's experience of violence. So when you get hit in the head the first time, you say, oh, now I get it. He's not hitting me in the head. He's not hitting me in the face. He's punching me in the brain. The damage is done to the brain. The object is to hit the brain. The object is try to shut down the other guy's brain. Temporarily, everyone prays. At bottom, these sports are, more than anything, they're brain damage contests. Mm. How much brain damage can you inflict on one guy, and how much brain damage can you take? That's what we mean when we say that that fighter has a good chin. It means you can punch him in the brain a lot, and he won't die. and there's also, the other thing I learned was after that 1 minute, you know, I felt like we had been fighting forever and I was exhausted.
Yeah, you're gassed.
When you mix the heavy work of grappling, so all the wrestling elements with all the speed work of the punching and the dancing and the kicking, it's hard to explain how tiring it is. I felt like I was sprinting uphill. I felt like I was just drowning, in a sea of air.
These are duels. I mean, because you explain in the book how cage fighting or prize fighting today shares this kinship with dueling, and they go back hundreds of years, millions of years, really. And we've sort of talked about that, but the dueling codes of British working men, for example, is something you write mm-hmm. about, those first. Really, ritual, I think, is really important. The idea that they set up these kind of standards and these. I guess rules. That's the point.
Yeah. So, you know, while British aristocrats back in the 18th century were shooting holes in each other and stabbing each other over their little kerfuffles, British working men were dueling as well, but they tended to duel with their fists. And, you know, all the rituals of the modern prize fight, all the things that we see in a boxing match or an MMA contest – almost all of those rituals were directly transferred from the dueling codes of British working men. Things like having, you know, taking your shirt off, you know, fighting without a shirt. Things like having a handshake. Things like a spirit of fair play. Having a ring. Having seconds who negotiate for you and work your corner. All of these things were directly transferred from the dueling codes of British working men. So what you have in a modern prize fight isn't just a sporting contest. What you have is a counterfeit theatrical duel. And that's part of what draws us into it. Mm-hmm. Not just that these guys are going to have a sporting contest, but the promoter will try to tell us that there's some sort of beef between these guys.
Yeah.
Some sort of real animosity that they're going to actually work out in the cage or in the ring.
One thing you do, though, and I think it's important to say, you do also like to burst the bubble of the sort of myth of all of this, too, because you write about boxing literature, for example, how lyrical and beautiful it can be. Yeah. And you say in the book there's this kind of sentiment that runs through it, that somehow the savagery of fighting is redeemed, as you put it, by the lofty emotions that it inspires. But it seems like you want us to be really honest about it, that in many ways we can be really hypocritical about all of this.
Yeah, so there's this great tradition, I mean a really wonderful tradition, a literature, in fact, of fight writing.
Yeah.
We have people like Hemingway weighing in. We have people like Norman Mailer and George Plimpton and other heavyweights. You know, Joyce Carol Oates has written beautifully about boxing. And there is this sense, you know, that that the savagery of the contest, it inspires these really deep, these tragic emotions, and somehow the fact that it makes the viewer experience these emotions somehow, makes it okay. Mm. Whereas I think it's a more complicated thing than that. You know, I think that we have to face the fact that, you know, that this is a morally complex behavior, watching these fights. Whatever damage is done to the fighters, the fans are at bottom morally culpable for it because we are the ones that are footing the bill for the contest.
Gladiators, those contests in ancient Rome you mentioned. You mentioned how crowds loved to go watch a public hanging. These are the kind of rude and nasty pleasures that but you say it seems like we've always had this appetite for bloodshed. I guess this is the kind of the darker side of all of this on some level.
Yeah, but I don't think that's all there is to it. You know,
right.
I think it's two-sided. Yeah. You know, so partly, you know, I do get into this, like the attraction of spectacles of violence, everything from the gladiators to public hangings to, you know, going back to, you know, the entertainment that we consume, the novels, the video games, the films, classic literature like Shakespeare and Tolstoy, all of it is gore-splattered. So I think there is a creature in us that is attracted to violence. But I don't think that is the main thing that's attracting us to a sport fight. I really don't. Here's why. I don't want to watch ISIS torture/murder videos. And I don't think you probably do either. I don't think many people in the audience do. And if we were just wanting to watch blood and pain, we wouldn't bother bucking up for the tame violence of a boxing match or a cage fight. We just fire up our internet browser and watch internet snuff videos all day. What really attracts us to these fights, I do think, is the drama of them. It's an incredibly intense showdown between two guys, an incredibly decisive climax to a story that promoters have been spinning in the lead up to the fight. And it's just this form of drama that's really intensely engaging to us. And by the way, I think counterintuitively, part of what draws us to these fights isn't just the worst angels of human nature. It's the best angels, too. So what a fight does is it sets up a sort of counterfeit life and death situation that sort of forces the best elements of human nature to show themselves. I'm talking about things like courage and tenacity and perseverance and stamina and extremes of grace. So, you know, I think we tune into a sport fight partly for dark reasons, but partly we're going there to celebrate and to honor these best elements of human nature.
You say that part of the riddle of the traditional duel is why it is we stopped fighting them. And you talk about how the culture shifted, and shifted really quickly, you mention, mm-hmm. and how the culture of honor started to fade away, and what took its place was Leviathan. Would you explain that and what you think the implications are for a culture of honor fading away?
Well, yeah, the duel emerged in a time when Leviathan was weak. And Leviathan is Thomas Hobbes's name for the whole apparatus of state power.
Yeah.
Everything from the laws to the police to the jailers. And Leviathan was weak, and so men were largely responsible for getting their own justice. And so the duel emerged as a way of enforcing certain rules of behavior. You didn't necessarily duel over the insult. You dueled, you know, that insult is spilled milk. You dueled to even to stop the other man from even thinking about spilling your milk. It was a form of deterrence. In this moment of extreme risk, you would demonstrate to the whole world that I will literally fight you to the death if you cross me. And that gives other people very good reasons not to cross you. The culture of honor begins to gradually fade away, and with it the formal duel, as Leviathan grows in strength, and Leviathan, the state, starts demanding a monopoly on violence. And so that those sort of planned out, traditional, elaborate duels, those go away, but not the sort of spontaneous, lightning fast sort of fights that men still do get into over honor.
Jonathan Gottschall is with us. His book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment with Jonathan Gottschall. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer Jonathan Gottschall. We're talking about his book, The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. A part of the book, you raise this question, which probably is a little dicey to write about, and to this question of masculinity and the differences between men and women in terms of violence. Sex differences, though, they're an important part of this story, it seems like, in terms of competition and violent behavior. Talk a little bit about that and whether you worried about this, because this, you know, this question of masculinity and femininity, it must be hard to write about.
Oh, it's atrocious to write about it. It's terrifying to write about it. I'm always just as scared about writing about gender as I was about having the cage fight. You open yourself up to a whole different kind of violence when you write about this subject, and when you write and you come at it in a way that might strike many people as incorrect politically. I believe that there is some biology to gender differences. The bull, you know, is different than the cow. The stallion is different than the mare. The female gorilla or chimp is different than the male version. They all differ not just in their physical characteristics, but in their behavioral characteristics too. And why should that be different for people? Why should we be an exception to that rule? And I don't think we're an exception to the rule. Now, that's not to say that everything about gender is biologically determined. Clearly, mm-hmm. it's not. Right. All you have to do is look around you and see the massive changes in women's lives over the last 100 years to know that is not the case. Biology is not destiny. But, you know, there are some biology-based sex differences. And in the subject matter covered in my book, this is aggressive behavior, mm-hmm. intensely competitive behavior, and physically violent behavior. These are the areas where the differences between the sexes are at their most massive and where the biological component of those differences is least controversial.
Well, Jody sends this question. Women box, she mentions. Women do mixed martial arts. They play contact sports. Is the experience different for them in some way than men?
Yeah. You know, so we're talking about averages here. So women do all of those things, and women do also commit murder. Women will kill each other. But they do so about 30 to 40 times less frequently than men kill each other. So it's not saying that women don't fight. It's that women fight differently than men do, and they fight less often. The reason my book focused on men's fighting because I wanted to write a book not just about combat sport, but about the whole problem of violence in the world. And when you talk about the problem of violence in the world, you are talking about men. Are women and men who engage in these kinds of types of sport, do they have the same sort of motivational structure? I don't think they do. Women compete much less frequently in boxing and mixed martial arts. There are some wonderful female fighters, but they are a very strong minority. And I think they're driven to it by different things. You know, most guys who go into mixed martial arts are not professionals, they're amateurs, and they're going into it to learn how to fight. They want to be able to defend themselves in the outside world. They want to be able to stand to bullies. They don't want to be dishonored and unmanned in a social situation. Most women aren't worried about that. They're going in for some sort of test. They have their reasons, but they're not worried about getting in kind of silly honor-based fist fights on the street.
You write about rites of passage. And this goes culturally. Men in particular, in a lot of cultures anyway, go through these rites of passage. Talk a little bit about this part of it. Well, I mean, one of the things that you went through, the amateur boxing tournament Tough Man, for example.
Yeah.
Talk about that part of the story.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, I did. I went to I'm on the border with West Virginia, and I went to Wheeling, West Virginia to see a Tough Man boxing contest, and it was fascinating. It's an unskilled amateur boxing contest where men basically get into the cage and they just brawl. And it is not a test of skill. It is not a test of your slickness as a boxer. It is a test of raw courage and raw toughness. And it's a sort of rite of passage that these young men are putting themselves through. It's a rite of passage that men give themselves now that formal, traditional rites of passage are sort of on the fade. Mm-hmm. Most societies around the world have had rites of passage for men and for women. But men's rites of passage have been much different than those that have been typical for women. They've been tests of whether a young guy has what it takes to be a real man. Is he tough? Is he strong? Is he brave? Can he tolerate pain? And now we have this world that's gotten softer and safer, and we don't see a need for these sorts of rites of passage for our young men. But many young men still go out and look for them. And one way they do so is in the Tough Man cage. And one way they do so is on the amateur mixed martial arts circuit where I trained and fought.
That is a big question about whether these impulses are fading away in any way, because I understand how these impulses are, you know, deeply embedded in our biology and how strong they remain. But do you think, Jonathan Gottschall, that there's any chance human culture is starting to dilute some of these impulses, or that we're in some way evolving away from, you know, these rituals in a way that could be counterproductive? I mean, if this is a check on violence and we strip it away because we think it's barbaric, could we become in some ironic way more dangerous as a species?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. That's a great question. In one sense, let's go back to the first part of your question. In one sense, yeah, society is evolving, and in very good ways. You know, so Steven Pinker has written about an 800-page tome proving in great detail that the world has become a much, much safer place, that our odds of dying violently are much smaller, much lower than they used to be. There's never been a really safer place, safer time to be alive. Now, the question that you asked is, could taking away some of these rituals actually lead to more sorts of conflict and more carnage? I think that's possible. But I think what's happened is we've found ways to refine these contests more and more. Mm-hmm. So we have things like sports, for instance, where young men are able to thrash out their hierarchies, figure out who's big and strong and tough and brave without having to fight at all. They can do it in a wrestling match. They can do it playing basketball. I think these sorts of rituals still exist. They've just gotten more and more refined and farther away from bloody fisticuffs. Mm.
But then you write about bare knuckle fighting, because you've talked about how in this effort to civilize combat sports, that authorities said, oh, let's pad the gloves. And yeah. You said that, this is how you put it, that instantly made the sport far more savage.
Oh my gosh, it was the worst mistake in history. Yeah, people have the wrong idea about the gloves. They have the wrong idea. People think they make fighting sports safer. Mm. And in fact, they do make it safer. They make it much, much safer for the hands. But the consequence of making it safer for the hands is you make it much, much more dangerous for the brain. And here's why. The human hand is a very fragile bludgeon, has these little bones. It's not much of a match, really, for the big, heavy, robust bones of the skull. But if you take that fragile hand and you wind it up tightly in tape, and then you encase it in foam and leather, you turn the fragile weapon of the human hand into this really dangerous cudgel that the men can throw around with wild abandon. If a bare-fisted fighter threw his hands as furiously as a gloved fighter throws his hands, the bare-fisted fighter would quickly reduce his hands to sleeves of shattered bone. Right. So there is a way to make combat sports safer. And it's a very simple move. You can just strip off the gloves, and a lot of the neurological danger will diminish.
Let's come back around to your fight. You finally have this fight you've been training for 15 months. A young man by the name of Justin McCloskey. And you have a game plan, and the idea was to take him down and make him fight you off his back.
Bad idea.
Bad idea. Bad idea. Yeah. At what point did you figure that you were out of your league? I mean, you did take him down. You did take him down.
Yes, yes. I mean, in some ways I'm proud of the fight because I did execute my game plan. All the things that I worked on, I did right. But I didn't know anything about Justin going in. I didn't know if he was a boxer or a wrestler. I didn't know if he was left-handed or right-handed. I didn't know. These are very bad things not to know. I just knew that I was better as a ground fighter, so I would take him to the ground, try to make him fight me off of his back. And almost instantly, I was aware that this was a bad idea because you could just tell by the sophistication of his technique on the ground that he was better than me. The problem was, I was so inexperienced and so raw, and it was so new to me that I could not change up my game plan, and that was my undoing. I did win about 40. The fight lasted 47 seconds. I won the first 46 seconds.
Right.
And then I spectacularly lost that last second.
Which is, I have to say, a brilliant piece of writing. It's almost actually hard to read. You have your left arm extended pipe straight, as you put it, between his legs, and you can feel your elbow giving out, and you can feel the tendons and the muscles starting to, you know, really they're going to start popping at some point. You have to make this decision: do I let my arm get ruined, or do I tap out? And you tapped out. And it's interesting. It's interesting how you felt about all of that. This sense of shame. And I want to have you read something from the book here finally, as you're driving home after the fight.
Yeah. So I found, again, one of the things about doing this research, I found that losing a fight is not at all psychologically equivalent to losing at ping pong. Right. It's a much more damaging sort of experience. And so I write about that here. I drove home after the fight at midnight, trying not to use my aching left arm while slugging disgusting gas station coffee to stay awake and gorging my underweight body with huge quantities of disgusting gas station food, cheese popcorn, hot dogs, donuts, and cellophane. I was feeling broody and sad. For months, I've been dreaming of getting this fight behind me, but I felt none of the relief I had expected and zero sense of accomplishment. I just felt shame. I had been mastered by another man who had held me down in front of the crowd, in front of my friends and my wife, and had made me say uncle. When I tapped his knee, I was communicating to him in MMA sign language. You may not know the language, so let me translate. Please stop. I admit you are the better man. I acknowledge that you could end my life right now if you chose to. You do it first by snapping my arm at the elbow. At that point, I will be helpless, and you could joint me like my mom used to joint a roast chicken, yanking and twisting until my limbs gave with a crunch. Then you could finish me at your leisure by strangling or pounding, whichever you like. Referees stop fights when one man is rendered so helpless that the other man could kill him with only token resistance. Driving home from the fight, I dictated notes into my MP3 player, trying to nail down what I'd learned in my entire MMA experience. I concluded that I'd been wrong about MMA people, fighters and fans alike. I expected the fighters to be high school bully types and the fans to be sadistic voyeurs. They weren't. And I discovered that MMA is less about feasting the worst angels of human nature than cultivating the better ones. The whole project made me think differently about masculinity, about the codes and tendencies and rituals of manhood. It made me feel more compassion for my own sex, locked as we are, pathetically and sometimes tragically, into a lifetime of monkey dancing. Although it is perhaps regrettable that men are so competitive, so dominance-obsessed, it's still a lucky thing that we have our monkey dances. Most of the time, they keep our contests civilized.
That's Jonathan Gottschall. His book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. He joined us today from the studios WQED in Pittsburgh. Jonathan Gottschall, thank you very much for the time.
Doug, so much fun being on. Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.